So, welcome to another Hidden Wiltshire podcast, and this one is slightly different because it's a bit of a special, actually, and it relates to the video that you may have seen circulating around social media on YouTube that we did around Alton Barnes, Alton Priors, and all the hills above, which we did with our good friend and good friend of Hidden Wiltshire, David Carson. And of course, David is with us today just to introduce this. Hi, David.
Hi there, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Are you well?
Yes, fine, thanks.
Excellent. So just so the podcast listeners know who you are, would you like to just say a few words about yourself and introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yes, thanks. Well, I'm a native of the Pusey Vale. I've lived in the Pusey Vale all my life, really. My family have been farming here in Alton Barnes and Alton Priors since the late 19th century, and having grown up in such a special place, I've always been fascinated by its history, and I suppose that I've become the unofficial historian for the village.
And you're also something of an archaeologist, aren't you? Amateur, shall we say?
amateur archaeologist, yes,
He dabbles.
I dabbles. I've done started off digging with what was Devizes Museum, now Wiltshire Museum, when I was about 10 years old, and have always been interested in archaeology, never pursued it as a career, but yeah, it's something I'm fascinated with, so come back to it whenever I can.
And it was a conversation that we had quite, it was probably around April last year, I think, where I approached you and said, would you like to come on the podcast? And myself and Paul went across to see you in the village, and we had a chat about it. And then I don't know quite know how it evolved, but we suddenly seemed to talk ourselves into actually doing a video because I think it was just the whole backdrop, the scenery and everything. We were just saying how fantastic it was, and we suddenly thought, well, actually, be better off capturing the essence of this area much better on video than just over an audio. So that's how it evolved. And of course, at the time, we'd never done it before, so it was a bit of a first for all of us. So I mean, what did you think about it? Did you think it went well?
I thought it was great. I think, yes, exactly that. When I met you and Paul and we wandered around and chatted about the history of the village, a picture says a thousand words, doesn't it? And having to describe every single thing we saw in great detail would have made a podcast that probably lasted for half a day. So I think by filming and talking, we did justice not only to the landscape but also to some of the history. And obviously a conversation sparks off other conversations, and I think it was really useful for all of us to have that experience. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a great day. Luckily we chose one of the nicest days in September to do it.
I think it's partly driven by Glyn's sort of aerial shots as well, the drone shots, which just obviously have to be seen. You can't really describe those, and the sort of the thought process of having a sort of drone, particularly running along the sort of Wansdyke and that. I mean, it just cried out for a video, didn't it? So that probably had
Yeah,
something to do with
absolutely.
it.
And I think that stitching together of the drone footage, the landscape footage, and us talking in on location, really made it into something much better, I think, than we thought we were capable of doing, actually. So overall, it was a great team effort. But it was a case of we went out late last summer. August wasn't great weather, but that particular day we chose in early September, and the weather was perfect. And we spent a day. There were five of us on the day because we had a cameraman and a sort of assistant as well. So yeah, it was just quite hard work to get it done, but we got there in the end, and it was nice to get it out. But I think what I wanted to do was actually just do this as a special. So what we've done is I pulled down the audio from the video into a podcast just to give people an opportunity just to listen to it in a slightly different format. But overall, yeah, I thought it was good. And hopefully everyone can have a listen to this and appreciate some of the magic of what we were talking about that particular day. just behind us here, we've got Knapp Hill and Golden Ball Hill beyond that. What's Golden Ball Hill all about then? I mean,
well, I think Golden Ball Hill, they reckon, is named after the flowers that grow on the hill.
Right.
You'll be able to tell us, Paul. Little yellow cup-shaped flowers, but
buttercups.
No, they're not buttercups. They're something else. Anyway, that's one of the theories. Anyway, but I think what's interesting about Golden Ball is there was an archaeological excavation there back in the 1980s, and they discovered building platforms there, built onto the side of the hill, compressed chalk, post holes, and signs of fire pits. Dated to around about 3,500 BC, so that's some of the very earliest buildings that we know about in the area.
Yeah.
So, fascinating bit of a glimpse there into what might have been happening when everybody was living up on the high ground rather than down in the valley. Yeah.
I wonder where they got their water from up there.
I think predominantly it would have had to be dew ponds.
I
don't think there's any other way around it. And people talk about dew ponds being a sort of Victorian feature, but I think they're much, much more ancient than that. I can't see how else they would have managed. And to traipse down into the village to gather water and carry it back up would have been a massive effort.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, in those days it was pretty deeply forested and probably quite a scary place with lots of wild animals roaming around. You wouldn't want to do that too often, I don't think.
Even spirits.
Yeah, oh yes, all of that. Yeah.
And I guess just in front of that, I mean, if we could see it from here, is Knapp Hill.
Yep.
Now, Knapp Hill, I mean, we can see it actually here. There's an earthwork just below the summit that goes around the perimeter, which is, well, I guess some people might mistake it for an Iron Age hill fort, but it's much older than that, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's a causewayed enclosure, basically. So it has a number of ditches, but lots of entrances. So it was a place for keeping your animals safe.
Yeah.
And it was possibly used as habitation, but not for long periods. There wouldn't have actually been a village there. Certainly not a fortified village. More of a stockade, probably, around the inside the ditch, there would have been fencing of some sort, wooden fencing.
Yeah.
And that again dates to the Neolithic as well. So we're talking, you know, 3,500 BC again.
Yeah.
So if the village was on Golden Ball Hill, that's probably where they kept their animals.
Yeah.
And again, you know, we're in a Neolithic landscape, absolutely. Mm. And we just walked up over Adam's grave, which is again somewhere between 4,500 to 3,500 BC. So would have been in use concurrently at the same time. Sadly, rather badly excavated by a Victorian cleric, caved in from the top, we believe. But be wonderful to excavate that properly one day.
Yeah.
And it would be almost identical to the East Kennet Longborough inside chambered tomb, with niches for the human remains, which were normally allowed to rot outside before they were actually interred inside the niches. They stack the bones up. One on top of the other, very neatly, but they think that's probably what happened. They allowed the bodies to decompose and then put them in there. And of course it's orientated to the east, so in the morning the rising sun, as at East Kennet, would come through the doorway to bring new life. So incredible, really.
So in chronological order, you've got Golden Ball occupied first, then Knapp Hill. And then,
well, this might be even older than Golden Ball Hill. Yeah, so it's all, you know, as far as you can date these things, it's all within 1,000 years of each other. So we're talking anywhere from 4,500 BC to 3,500 BC. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, 5,500 years ago or more. It's quite a thought.
So we're actually stood here on the slopes of Adam's grave, and as we are here, I can really get a sense of the size and the scale of this thing. It's an enormous undertaking to have built this, but actually this area here has got some more recent history as well, hasn't it, David?
It has, yes. So Adam's grave was called by the Saxons Woden's Beorg, because Woden was the father of the gods, and so he was the oldest person in their culture.
Yeah.
So they named him Woden's Beorg, and named this Woden's Beorg. And in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, it's mentioned twice as being the site of some fairly major battles.
Mm.
And it's understood that possibly this was a ritual place to fight battles within this area. because it seems unusual to have two virtually on the same site, although separated by a couple of hundred years.
Yeah.
So the one that springs to mind is 592, and that was again Saxon, rival Saxon warlords basically punching each other up to succeed each other. No trace of the battle's ever been found, so we've no idea whether it was this side, it says beneath Wodensburg, whether it was to the north or to the south. We think it's more likely to be into the north, because again with the Wansdyke, which we're going to visit later, possibly being a boundary, that may have had something to do with it as well.
So what sort of, we're talking about Saxon.
Yes.
What date would that be?
Yes, well, it's the 6th century, basically. There are two battles named or mentioned, but I think the most decisive one was 592.
Okay.
And here, there's like a nice bowl almost carved out of the hillside, which is probably why you get quite a lot of paragliders and people up here, because of the winds.
It's a bottom. It's a Wiltshire bottom.
Yes.
Or a coombe.
Or a coombe, otherwise known as a coombe.
Yeah. Stunning, isn't it? Absolutely stunning up here. And in fact, you know, from the road going past St Bernard to Devizes, you can't really see how big this coombe is. You just get a glimpse of it, but actually seeing up here on a day like today, it's absolutely stunning.
And of course, with the sun being as strong as it is today, it's picking out all the folds of the landscape, the earthworks, and the banks and the ditches. So it's really accentuating those today. So we're really quite privileged today, I think. So often it's covered in sort of white cloud, isn't it? Or grey cloud.
And
looks blank.
It's a photographer's dream, really.
It is.
Yeah.
Fantastic for mid-September.
Yeah.
Considering August was dull and grey and cold.
Summer's arrived finally.
Yeah.
So here we're sat on some quite interesting Sarsen stones. Obviously we have quite a lot of Sarsen over in that direction, over towards Westwood and Fifield Down, but these kind of stand out as a sort of very small crop of Sarsens, and makes you wonder how they got here, or whether they were originally here or offloaded from a cart or something.
Yeah, I think they are original. I'm sure no one's going to move stones this size for fun, and they serve no useful purpose here on the Down. So I think they're just part of the original Sarsen stone capping on top of the chalk, and so many were moved and used for building and road making. But it's lovely to see them here as they were.
So we're actually standing on the Wansdyke now, and quite an impressive structure it is, having just walked through the bottom of it. I mean, the sides of it are incredibly steep, aren't they, David?
Really steep, and if you walk it all the way from westwards towards Morgan's Hill and Devizes, you'll come across bits which are incredibly steep, amazing bits of civil engineering, really. And wherever possible, utilising the contours of the hills to make it even more formidable. One of the questions, of course, is how many people did it take to actually create this? And ultimately, the big question is, when was it actually done? Which are questions that are being debated at the moment.
And who built it and why?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that.
Extraordinary.
But it's three theories, isn't there, as to who built it and why, and whether it was defensive, whether it was to keep keep the Danes out, or to keep somebody else in, and whether the Romans had a hand in it. But for years, nobody's really been sure.
No, they haven't. And of course, what's been fascinating is we've actually had a archaeological excavation here back in the tail end of June, beginning of July, by University College London. And they were digging on a small section of unscheduled ancient monument to look at its construction, and also to do analysis to find out if they could determine when the monument was started. the theory that they're working on, which is seems to be the one that gains most favour at the moment, is that it was built around about 800 as a dividing line between Wessex and Mercia.
Yeah.
And it was, as you can see, built as a defensive ditch and bank, and it extends all the way to Avonmouth and then all the way into Berkshire, but the most of it from Wiltshire onwards is extinct in Somerset, has disappeared, and what little remains of it in Berkshire is very puny by comparison. This is probably the best stretch that we've just walked along.
Yeah.
Going back to the engineering, there really is some sort of mystery over how many men it must have taken to construct it and how long it took to put up. When you think that you know, the population of Wessex by comparison with today was quite tiny, this would have been a kingdom-wide effort. It wouldn't have just been villagers from the Pusey Vale mucking in and helping out. They could never have done it. And also they got to take into account the seasonality of it. You couldn't work on this sort of earth monument in the middle of winter, because it would have got wet and the whole thing would have just collapsed on itself. And you probably would be confined to working around the harvest season as well, because everyone was needed to bring the harvest in and to plant it. So all those questions hopefully are going to be answered slowly. But if we can get the dating, then that will be the first step, and that will be fascinating. So within, you know, the next 3 or 4 months, we're hoping to hear what the date might be, and that will be definitive. And it's the same method they've just used on the Cerne Abbas Giant down in Dorset, which proved conclusively that there's a very similar date. That was late Saxon, so interesting stuff. And the other thing I should mention about Wansdyke is they've been looking at parish boundaries and whether the Wansdyke respected parish boundaries, so whether it was a pre-parish boundary construction, and it doesn't. So parish boundaries cross through Wansdyke, which is fascinating. Yeah. And actually not far from where we're standing now were the Stanton St Bernard gallows, and they were again on Wansdyke. It was regarded as being outside the village and a place where things like that could be done, because it was a lot of superstition about hanging people and their spirits coming back and haunting. Yeah. So
so you don't want it in your parish, do you?
You don't, no. So, yeah, the old... So the Saxon parishes, which still exist today, I mean, all our, you know, village parishes boundaries are Saxon, but they're probably pre-Saxon. They could even be Roman. They could have been boundaries for estates. No one really knows, because nothing was written down.
Yeah.
So we've just come down off the hills. Actually, we can still see them in the distance. Literally, in my line of sight, I can see Adam's grave in the distance. But we come down to the villages now, and we're here in the village of Alton Priors, just outside the church here. So, I mean, what can you tell us about Alton Priors, David?
Well, both the villages, Alton Barnes and Alton Priors, have the same first name, Alton, which is a Saxon word, which loosely translated means settlement by a stream. So that's where the Alton comes from. And the Priors bit for Alton Priors comes from the fact that it was after the Battle of Rawton in 825. It was ceded to the Bishop of, the Cathedral Church of St. Peter and St. Paul Winchester, which was a priory church. And so it was owned by the priory. So it became Alton Priors, basically.
Oh, okay.
So that's the ownership. That's what it's all about. As opposed to Alton Barnes, which has got a... another source, we believe, from the Lord of the Manor, who held both Stanton St Bernard and Alton Barnes, and the name is De Berners. So in the case of Stanton, it's been sort of changed to St Bernard, and in the case of Barnes, it was called Alton Berners, has become Alton Barnes. So that's the reason behind it. So, I mean, this is a lovely, you know, Norman church with a very early Saxon doorway. Which has been sealed up facing north with a very early Christian cross, almost like a Maltese cross, with roundels carved into it.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because they often did that. I mean, the Norman churches were built on top of what were Saxon churches, and presumably the Saxon churches were built on top of what could have been pre-Christian places. So this could have been an original holy place for I think the ancients.
Without a doubt it was, and in a minute we're going to go around the other side of the church and look at a very ancient tree.
Yep.
But before we do so, of course, we've got here via the hollow, which
yes.
brought us from Adam's grave, which is we're looking at over there. So that hollow way connects the hills up there with this place.
It does.
And I guess would have been used by people, you know, to over you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years, to migrate from living up there to living down here by a source of water.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't hollow following the path of the old Ridgeway?
It is, yeah. It's the extension from Avebury on right. across Salisbury Plain that eventually winds its way to Lyme Regis, I believe.
Yeah.
It's
wow.
I mean, it's very definite here, and it peters out towards the Kennet Naven Canal. It virtually disappears, and then it's difficult to pick up again until up onto Salisbury Plain. But
yeah.
I like to think of it really as the Wansdyke and the Ridgeway of being, you know, major cross-country routes.
It makes sense.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's almost like the M4 and the M25 now.
Yeah.
And people would have been going each and every way.
Yeah.
And certainly this would have been a stop-off on the way. I mean, and the reason the Saxon village arrived here was clearly because of the springs, which is the source of the River Avon.
Yeah.
They are the most northerly source of the River Avon.
I quite like having that sort of connection. You know, they're not two distinct places, but, you know, there's here and there's there.
Yeah.
And they're connected by that old route, that old trackway. Which, of course, continues the other side of the church.
It does.
We're going to go around the other side.
We'll go and have a look.
Going across the meadows there.
A lot of people find it very strange to think that they're two little tiny villages, each with a church of their own. And, you know, they can't understand why we don't share one church, but they were in separate ownership for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Yeah.
So, therefore, each was a separate community, separated by a tiny little stream.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was always been, and up until certainly the early part of the 20th century, the vicar for this church came from West Overton, from Alton Priors, and Alton Barnes had its own rector and a very fine house to go with it. But, you know, vagaries of history.
Yeah. Well, this tree is old.
It certainly is. It's 1,700 years old, apparently. So it's one of those rare occasions where the church is here because of the tree, not the other way around. So
yeah, the church probably predates Christianity in this part of the world.
The tree does.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So the tree was no doubt part of a, you know, a ritual sacred site dating back to prehistory. And I think along with the springs and the tree, and there was very possibly some stones here. We've got one stone inside the church we'll have a look at later, which may have been a standing stone. So it's, really interesting.
You can see it's kind of built on an elevation, as if there's some kind of an earthwork of some sort.
Yeah,
here, but
I think there's very definitely a slope down on the south side there. It's more pronounced on the south, but it's certainly a raised platform all the way around. But of course it's been disturbed by graves being dug and the church being built. But we'll certainly go inside and have a look at that stone in a minute.
So these curious marks, I mean, they look like they're gouge marks, really. I mean, they're little pits, almost holes in the wall. So what are these then, Dave?
Well, we think they're musket ball strikes, and they're certainly sort of military caliber shot. It's not the sort of thing that you would go wild filing with. And the inference that we've, or the conclusion I've reached, having read through the parish records, I'm going to read a bit to you from the parish records. This is July the 15th, 1643. It says, paid for the shoeing the horses of my Lord Wilmot and his troops who lay in both Altons then. So the interesting fact about that is that was the day after the Battle of Ranway Down, where Lord Wilmot led the Royalist cavalry, rode them from Oxford. There was a Royalist victory, as you know, at Ranway. And he obviously then moved 5 or 6 miles down the Pusey Vale and decided to bring his regiment here to water the horses, to sort out the shoes before they returned to Oxford. So, you know, I've got no proof, but it's clear to me that, you know, the spread of musket balls, as you can see, going right the way round.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a gap in the middle where there's not very much going on. But I wonder if they'd actually hung some sort of effigy off the sundial, which should have been there then, and we're using it as target practice. But we'll probably never know. But I think it's a pretty strong bet that that's the day it happened. You know, we can almost tie it down to the day in history.
So we've just been inside the church now and had a good look around. But the thing that struck me is that there was a trap door.
Mm-hmm.
Underneath the trap door was the sarsen stone.
That's right. Well, that was discovered when the church was handed over from the Church of England to the Church's Conservation Trust back in the 1970s. They had to take the whole floor up. And underneath the floor, they discovered that sarsen. And they thought they'd keep it accessible to the public. So they built the hatch over the top. Yep. So that's a fairly recent invention. But again, you know, we have no proof. But it strikes me that this was a symbol of pre-Christian worship that was brought inside the church to help the local inhabitants accept that the church was the new form of worship.
Yeah.
And by putting the stone there, even though they've broken it, it's been fractured and rotated through 180 degrees. So it's clearly been broken as a sign that the old religion has died. But, you know, as a gesture, we've shoved it under the floor. Yeah. Again, there's no proof for any of that. But sarsens with holes in them are regarded as quite special, as you probably come across, because the stone is so hard that to have a hole all the way through is really quite special. So I think, again, one can surmise. That's all we can do. There may well have been standing stones in this area with the yew tree associated with a pre-Christian site of worship. We'll never probably know. It's probably almost impossible to do a geophys survey of the churchyard because of all the graves that have been dug. The amount of disturbance is such that I think it would be almost impossible. But, yeah, I think this has been a special place for millennia, definitely.
So we're in between the churches of Alton Priors and Alton Barnes, and the meadows around here, there's signs of Saxon settlement, isn't it, in these meadows?
Certainly here you can see the earthworks of the village. Yeah.
That's right. So, I mean, essentially, the original village was made out of cob and thatch and has long since gone. So the later buildings from the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries have formed a sort of square, if you like, an outer ring around the original medieval village.
Yeah.
And the medieval village has turned into open meadows, which is rather nice. So all that remains, really, is the later housing around the edge. And there's still lots of building platforms here, and this is an archaeologically sensitive site, so we're not allowed to plough it or do anything to disturb the ground underneath.
And I suppose by moving away from here, it's less boggy as well.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, a lot of the houses, the older houses that have cellars, flood in the spring. They fill up with water. Yeah. My house fills up with water.
Yeah.
But I just have to accept it. It's just part of the part of the cycle, really.
Mm. Yeah.
So, onwards and upwards.
Yeah, go to the church.
Right.
Through the turnstile. So this rather impressive paved path that leads all the way to Alton Barnes.
It does, and We know when this happened. It happened in 1830 because the villagers of Alton Priors were getting absolutely fed up with not having any church services, because the rector for Alton Priors was the rector of West Overton, had to ride across the downs on horseback, and clearly on a wet, soggy November morning he wasn't going to bother. And I think that became a habit of not bothering. And so when the new rector arrived by the name of Augustus Hare in 1830, the villagers of Alton Priors petitioned him to take services in their church, which he readily agreed to. But he said, I'm not going to do that unless I have a path, because I'll get my cassock absolutely covered in mud. So this is the reason this path's here. And it's made out of sarsen stones, beautifully laid. And it goes all the way from the rectory in Alton Barnes to All Saints Alton Priors.
But bearing in mind the two churches are about 300 metres apart.
They are.
It was a real hardship, wasn't it?
It was a hardship. He didn't mind the distance, it was the mud.
Yeah.
And you can imagine in the middle of winter when this field has been really hoiked up by cattle, it was pretty unpleasant.
Mm.
So we've got a lovely path thanks to the rector.
So here we are outside another church. This one's in Alton Barnes, and this one is the oldest one here, isn't it? This is the original Saxon church.
Yes, this is St Mary's Alton Barnes, and what you can see beneath the pebble dash on the lower layers is the original Saxon stonework And this is the blocked up north doorway, which was Saxon. So you can see these fairly substantial pieces of stone here and the stone footings at the bottom. And these other details here are, this detail here is a pilaster, which is repeated all the way around. So yeah, this is a pre-Norman Conquest church. So
you don't see so lucky. Many of them around anymore, do you?
No, they're very few and far between. Obviously, the Bradford-on-Avon's got a very famous one. But to have one that's almost intact, obviously the roof has been replaced. In the 15th century, the timbers were replaced. It's got Cotswold stone tiles. We've recently spent a lot of money on restoring it inside and out. But, you know, it's unique. Very, very lucky to have it.
And this end, obviously, is newer.
Yeah, that's right.
But what about the base? Is that...
Yeah, that's also... No, that's been reused, yes.
Yeah, different size stone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Water.
Yeah, so that's a Georgian chancel.
Oh, Georgian.
Yeah.
Okay, but going to a bit more recent history, what's the story about the machine riots and how they impacted on this area, David?
Right, well, the agricultural machine riots happened in the late 1820s into 1830, result of agricultural labourers being basically losing their jobs because of mechanisation. So the advent of the seed drill, amongst others, the threshing machine, all of these things were making life easier for farmers, but harder for farm workers to find work. There was a lot of unrest in the countryside, and groups of men went from farm to farm, breaking up these machines, setting fire to them, setting fire to farmers' possessions. And it actually hit Alton Barnes in 1830. And I'm fortunate to have a letter, which I'm going to read to you, written by the rector to a friend. This was the 24th of November, 1830. And he says, "For fear you should be alarmed by cross-country accounts in the newspapers, I write a few lines to say we were all safe after one of the most painful days I ever went through. About 2 o'clock, we were summoned by two half-drunken men who professed to be sent on. They came to the door and asked for money, any trifle, announcing that 200 were coming at their heels. After failing of their errand, they went down to Pyle's house opposite us," and that's just through the trees there. That's Robert Pyle's house. "Whither I followed them. He was gone to Marlborough, and there were none but women in the house. As the only chance, I had the church bell rung," which is just up there behind us. "But none of the labourers came. Perhaps they were too far off and did not hear. About 10 minutes after the troop arrived, the thrashing machine had been taken to pieces," and that thrashing machine was located just in the farmyard, just opposite us now. "They must break it, and breaking it they were when Pyle on horseback dashed in amongst them and fired his pistol. They would have dispersed, perhaps in a fright, but in a place where they could close with him, his gun went off a second time. They dragged him down and have nearly killed him. They then burst into his house and broke everything to pieces, and for some time I expected they would serve us in the same way. So irritated were they and so mad with drink. Indeed, they talked of coming back tonight and burning down all his ricks and barns. But the news had reached Devizes even before I could send a messenger. The yeomanry were here by six. I have just heard they have surprised several of the rioters in the public house in Woodborough." So, great first-hand account of what it was like. It must have been terrifying. And the house was completely mullered. They went in there and smashed everything up. And I think there's another story of this event, where that Robert Pyle's manservant, actually, who was a big lad, went in and picked him up physically and took him to the house and barricaded the doors to stop them getting in. But, I mean, he could have been killed.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Quite easily. And, in fact... the yeomanry, the Royal Wiltshire Yeomanry, they weren't royal at that stage, they were the Wiltshire Yeomanry Cavalry, who were sent, because there was no standing police force in the county in those days, they were the police, basically. They were called out. They suppressed the machine riots in Wiltshire with such ferocity and so well, they were then granted the title royal because they did such a good job. And they put an end to it quite quickly. Wow. But, I mean, they were doing, rather like Peterloo, they were doing full-scale cavalry charges on farm labourers.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. I don't think many were killed, but it was certainly pretty fearsome.
But some of them were transported, weren't they?
They were. The rioters were mostly transported to Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a genuine grievance, no doubt at all about it. But, unfortunately, a lot of the people who were on these marches and doing the burning and the looting weren't actually farm labourers. They were just people who jumped on the bandwagon. Yeah. And we see that today, don't we, with protests.
Well, in that letter as well, I mean, they were clearly full of drink.
They were full of drink.
And obviously up for a scrap. A bit like you get, you know, the football hooligans.
Exactly.
It's exactly the same. Nothing ever changes.
It doesn't change, you know. And I think the same with road protests and everything else. There's some genuine people in there with a message, but they're people... jump on the bandwagon. So
So the yeomanry, who would have funded that? Were they actually...
They're funded by the government.
Oh, so it was the army.
They were set up... Well, they were reserve cavalry.
Okay.
They were set up in 1794 in Wiltshire to augment the regular army in case of a French invasion by Napoleon, because we were terrified that Napoleon was going to invade. They were sort of equivalent in a way of the Dad's army at the time, but a little grander than that. So all the great landed families in Wiltshire provided the officers... So there was the Aylesbury's from Tottenham House in Savernake Forest. There were the Tynes from Longleat. There were the Methuins from Corsham Court. Virtually every family you could name in Wiltshire was an officer in the Wiltshire Yeomanry.
Right.
And their tenants were the soldiers, basically. But they were all good horsemen.
Yeah.
But they weren't allowed to deploy outside the boundaries of the county of Wiltshire. They had to stay within the county until the... the Boer War in 1900, when they desperately needed good countrymen who were good at horseback riding to deal with the Boers. And so they then formed the Imperial Yeomanry, which allowed whole regiments to join a different organisation, which were allowed to deploy abroad. So that was their first proper engagement. And they did really well because they were all countrymen. They were good shots.
Yeah.
They were good riders. Yeah. But yes, this was the time before 1830, before a police force, of course. And even the Peelers in London, I think, came soon after that. Interesting times. But clearly, you know, to have an eyewitness account is just fantastic from the rector who lived here.
And so good to actually hear that read out in this place where we can see the house.
Where it happened.
We can hear, we can see the church bells. Yeah. We can see the churchyard. It just brings it alive.
Yeah.
So I hope you've enjoyed listening to that. It was actually recorded over a year ago now, although the video only went live on YouTube in February of this year, I think, 2022. So you can find it on YouTube if you search for Hidden Wiltshire. You'll find there's a few other videos up on the channel too from the past. Not quite up to the standard of this one, I must add, but there are plans afoot to add to that content and develop the video channel in the months and year ahead. But as for the podcast, all good things must eventually end. And with this special episode, I'm also announcing that this will be the last podcast for a while. We're putting the podcast on a hiatus, although, of course, the 40 previous episodes will always be there and available for a re-listen if you fancy it. You can still follow all things Hidden Wiltshire, though. The website is still there and getting added to on a regular basis by people like myself, like Paul Timlett and Elaine Perkins and others. That website is at hiddenwiltshire.com. On that website, you can also still get copies of the Hidden Wiltshire book, which we produced and released around this time last year. So we still got that available for sale on the website. It's also available in Wiltshire Museum and in Devizes Books and Devizes. You can also still find the Facebook page, the YouTube channel, of course, which we've already just talked about. But finally, a massive, massive thanks to my podcasting partner, Mr. Paul Timlett. Our Hidden Wiltshire musician, Mr. Steve Dixon, he's very kindly provided all of the music for these podcasts over the last couple of years. And most importantly, thanks to you, dear listener, for being there. Until the next time, au revoir.